Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim.
Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're going to be revisiting a conversation that we had some time ago with Dave Murphy. Dave was, previous to retirement, he was the president and CEO of Red Wing Shoe Company, and he led the company through a period of growth, and he's got some great insights around leadership and managing your career, and looking forward to today's conversation with Dave. Dave, appreciate you taking time out to talk with us.
Yep, happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I guess first off, can you give us just a little bit of your career history, a little bit of your story?
Sure. So I went to college out east and then to business school out west. And then after business school came back, I'm actually from the Minneapolis area, grew up here, ended up looking around the country for different opportunities. I'd fallen in love with marketing, was kind of the discipline that interested me. And so I came back to General Mills, which is, of course, the multi-billion-dollar food company and packaged goods company. And I started right out of college or right out of business school with General Mills and started on Cheerios as a junior marketing person.
Okay.
And so I spent 23 years at General Mills in different levels and different businesses from, you know, more commodity to very consumer driven, brand advertising driven. And learned a lot about, you know, smaller divisions, bigger divisions, high margin businesses, low margin businesses, all of that. Lived out of the country for a period of time with a company. Did a lot of international, domestic, all sorts of things, which was a great training ground. And General Mills is known for really being great in their training of their people for management. And so I went up the ladder for a period of time. And then it became clear at some point I wasn't going to be the CEO. I always had wanted to run a business. I had found actually that I loved managing smaller businesses within the company than big businesses. Ones where I could get my hands all the way around the business and leave my fingerprints more completely on an organization. And so that led me to Red Wing Shoe Company, which a privately held company. And one that I really, really loved, and retired from there several years ago. So that was kind of the core of my career. So marketing early on, and then fairly early into general management roles, and then CEO of Red Wing for 15 years before retiring.
Great. Well, knowing what you know now, looking back, if you were able to go back and talk to a 22-year-old Dave, what advice would you give him?
You know, maybe now more than ever, I think about many decisions and many issues and problems are not black and white. They're tremendous shades of gray. And when I was young, I thought, well, it's this or it's this. And I was actually fairly stubborn, you know, when I was debating, even as a junior, I was an outspoken, always been fairly outspoken with a point of view. And I still believe it's appropriate to have a point of view, but to acknowledge there isn't always just one right answer. And sometimes it's not quite as clear cut as one might think. And, you know, I don't think we'll get too much into politics here, but clearly the world we've been living in for quite a while here now has been very black and white. Either you're for one candidate or for the other candidate, and the other is kind of demonized and definitely wrong, and this one's right. And so I've learned the world isn't quite that simple. So recognize that many decisions, most involve shades of gray.
So is there any advice that you received early on that you wish you would have ignored?
You know, I actually got some advice that I did ignore. So I'll answer your question.
Okay, sure.
You might remember the book, What Color Is My Parachute? Mm-hmm. And there are books that help people manage their career. And I remember speaking once at a fairly large event, business event, where the author of that book was speaking and giving tips on how to manage your career. And I followed him. And I don't think you should manage your career. I just think you should manage your business. So I've always been a real believer. And this too is not pure black and white, but I've really felt if you just focus on managing the business that you're charged with, everything will work out. Now, I've worked for wonderful companies, and they aren't caught up in, they've never been caught up in politics, or, you know, I think that they've treated anyone, regardless of their background, their skin color, their whatever, their beliefs, if they did the job, that they would be rewarded for it. And that's what I grew up with. And so I just felt the same. If I just did my job and did my very best, that the people, it would be to the company's benefit to see me succeed. So I never really, quote, managed my career, never asked for a raise, never asked for a certain job. I just kind of did my job. And then they'd tap me on the shoulder and say, we want you to go do this. And would you do that? And yeah, that sounds fun. So I managed my business as not my career.
Yeah. Well, were you the first CEO outside the family when you went to Red Wing?
Yes.
You the first.
Yes. So and you that had, was, you know, had its, it actually worked out incredibly well because the principal owner was the chair and the one who hired me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wanted to make sure that he was willing to let me manage the business. If he was looking for a number two, that's not what I was interested in. That could be valid, but it wasn't for me. And so we sat down before I joined the company. I said, now you got to let me run it. And he had a couple of simple ground rules that were very fair. And then he lived by them and I lived by them. And so it worked out really well.
Right. So coming into a brand that you're used to working for brands that had quite a reputation with General Mills, and then moving into another iconic brand with Red Wing shoes. What were some of the changes that you had as far as to kind of adapt to a different culture, kind of more of a family run business? Right. What was that like?
Fair point. So let me talk about what I needed to make sure I was thinking about in my own, the way I behaved and thought about. Mm-hmm. First of all, it came quite naturally to me. As I said earlier, I found that I enjoyed smaller businesses when I was at General Mills than bigger businesses. I felt that you could move quicker, you could touch the lives of the people you work with better. And so that's kind of who I am. My father was an executive at Graco, which is a Minneapolis-based company. It was private when he was there. It was fairly small. And I remember interacting with, you know, kind of tagging along once in a while on a work day. And so I could just tell that's kind of my DNA, is to connect in an intimate way. That's a leadership style I have, and it worked better in a small company. So that really came naturally. And I also am comfortable rolling up my sleeves and actually doing work, not just, you know, telling others to do work.
Sure.
So, and some people are great at leading and delegating huge organizations where they don't really do stuff. Now, I had to manage how often do you get your fingers into the business itself versus step back. But that too came fairly naturally. So that's one point. The second is I did have a lot to learn about retail. I did not know about really managing a retail business. Red Wing has many, many retail stores, and the direct connection with customers, independent shoe retailers, and our own retail environment, our own stores, was totally new to me. At General Mills, you focus on the brand more than you do the customer. I wasn't meeting with Super Value and Safeway that often. But in Red Wing, very, very driven around supporting and building the retail business. So that was great learning for me. And I had a number of people that were great at teaching me. And I think the fact that I clearly showed them that I needed to learn this and wanted to learn it made them more comfortable with me as a quote outsider. And then when I had ideas that I wanted to bring, they were more receptive because they saw that I didn't think I knew everything, but I had some areas where I could bring some expertise. And that was the other thing that was fun, is there were things that I had learned at General Mills that were fairly, basic in my mind that we weren't doing at Red Wing. And so I could bring that. So I felt I was adding value, which was rewarding. So those are great. Some of the reactions I had in the first several years I was there.
We talked a little bit before we got started, and I know you've done a number of talks on the subject of leadership lessons I learned from Macau.
Yeah.
And we wanted to talk a little bit about that and just some of your insights. And I love the title. Like I said, it intrigues me. So why don't you share a little bit about
that? Sure. So what I have done is I have what they call a side of a hide. A side is one half of a cow hide. Mm-hmm. So it's split down the backbone, and it's got everything from along the back and shoulder and tail down to the two legs. And it's about 25 square feet. It's pretty big. And I would take that hide, again, called a side, and I would hang it up on a little rack, and I would talk to people and show them this. And so I don't have that here, but there are a couple of parallels that I would draw, metaphors, if you will. And one is, there's half a dozen that I talk about, and I won't talk about them all, but there's a couple. One is the imperfect nature of a hide. There are no two, like snowflakes, there are no two cow hides that are the same. You know, they're scarred with barbed wire scars and a brand maybe. They're different sizes, they're different thicknesses, even kind of depending where you're cutting from. And so one of the things that a cutter, we call them, those that cut the pieces out of a hide to create the different parts of a shoe or a boot, they're like a cookie cutter, and they stamp it. And they have to move the hide around and cut in different ways because there's a grain has to be cut certain ways. And you can't, like on the toe of your boot, you can't have a big scar.
Sure.
It's weaker, and it doesn't look good. So you have to adapt your cutting to every single hide. Now, I happen to think that great leadership is where you adapt your own style to bring out the best in others, not force them to adapt to you. Now, that doesn't mean you compromise your principles or you compromise some of your own personality or who you are, or it's not that you would be somebody you're not, but you don't treat all employees exactly the same because none of them are the same. So you have to reflect on the different challenges that maybe a single mother has versus, you know, somebody else that doesn't have some of the challenges that they have. And so there's just a lot of different ways in which you try and adapt your leadership with the intent of getting the best out of the individuals, just as a cutter tries to get as much yield and quality out of every individual unique hide. So that's one. The other is, that I often talk about is the judgment. And I referred to this subject of gray, topics that are gray, and I'll share a quick story. But at the top of a cowhide, on the up along the back and the shoulder, it's very tough and thick. You can imagine that it would be to protect from the elements and so forth. But down in the belly, it can be very soft and thin. So in and of itself, a single side or hide has a tremendous variability, and it kind of changes from one to the next. So it starts out very firm and solid and thick and tough to very tender, but there's a shades of gray, if you will, between one and the other. And a cutter needs to be able to know, because you can't cut a toe piece from the soft, flexible part, or it'll break and come out of shape. It'll deform quickly. But the tongue of the boot, which we call a gusset, can be very soft. Now, the the issue, we once had a situation, I'll give you the very short version. An employee was found to have stolen from our company. And we had a very zero tolerance on stealing, because you have retail stores. And so if you steal a shoelace, you know, that's a problem. Anyway, this employee had stolen, and a very good performing employee, head of HR came to me and said, you know, we've got this situation with somebody has stolen from the company. And I said, well, what's to discuss? You know, we terminate when we have that situation. Person said, well, it's somebody that you know very well. I said, well, I mean, that doesn't let them off the hook. You know,
sure.
I mean,
right.
That doesn't matter. So, well, this person was stealing cookies from the cafeteria, that kind of an honor roll thing, stealing cookies. And I went, oh, well, I mean, and then I was like, so we got into quite a debate about, and then it turns out that the individual had an eating disorder. Hmm. And now you're talking about somebody who would come in, and it was very likely that the behavior involved this eating disorder. And so you went, wow, now it gets complicated. And it isn't just like, well, the employee stole, goodbye. Or, well, that's a illness that we have to treat, you know, we have to, you know, just forgive them. You know, so there, and where were we at? And boy, it was a hotly debated topic between the head of the department where the employee was and our HR and me. And it was a real education around recognizing. I remember when I was at business school, I don't remember even if we had ethics classes, but I know my alma mater, I went to Stanford Business School. They have classes on ethics. And there was a time when I thought, well, why do you need to go to a class to know right from wrong? I mean, you know, I grew up, I learned that in kindergarten, you know.
Sure. Yep.
What's right, what's wrong? I mean, are you kidding? And then in today's world, I really learned about these challenges of ethics. Even, again, some of the hotly debated topics like immigration and so forth, these are not easy decisions to know what's right. Mm-hmm. And this situation was one where it was not real easy to know what to do. Again, there's a wide range. So those are a couple of the stories that kind of connect with lessons I learned from a cow.
Now I can picture it now that we don't have the visual for everybody today, but I think the way you described it, we can see what you're talking about.
Yeah.
As you've worked with a number of different organizations, and it was kind of interesting that you left, you didn't include this in your story, but you, after you left Red Wing and retired from that, you went on and were an interim CEO at Fairview Health, which is a large multi-billion dollar organization. Again, you went into kind of an area that I think you had served on the board there. Is that correct?
Yep.
Prior to that?
Yes.
But that's a completely different industry. And talk a little bit about that. Yeah. Just some of the
sure.
experience you had.
So I was serving as the chairman of the board. Couple of lessons for myself. One was we needed to make a change in the CEO some years when I was, I think at the time, I might even been just vice chair at the time. But I was head of the search committee, and ultimately we hired an individual, and it turned out that individual wasn't a good fit, and that can happen, right? I mean, we've all made great hires, and we've all made hires that didn't work out, and so it didn't take long to realize this wasn't the right fit, and so number one, I felt that I owned the decision to hire the CEO, to hire him, so I owned resolving it, so we did let the CEO go. We did a fair transition and so forth. And then I felt some obligation to, because there had been such a short time, that somebody had to step in. So I stepped in as the interim CEO while I was still the CEO at Red Wing.
Ah, okay.
In two different towns, Red Wing, Minnesota, right. And sure. Minneapolis. So I did. I served as the CEO and the CEO of Red Wing both for a year, and then another year. Then I retired from Red Wing, and that had been planned. And so I served as another year as the interim CEO. So I was an interim CEO for about 2 years.
Okay.
While we did a search for a new CEO, which the second time around worked out really well, and James Hereford is still there. But a couple of things. At one point, I kind of naively thought that I could do it. The headhunter even said, would you be interested in applying for the job? And I said, well, I'm not interested, but I think I could do it. I said, there was a little ego there going on, too much, so I'm afraid. I'm embarrassed to say. And I learned that I wouldn't have been a good fit for several reasons, but principally when it came to management and leadership type needs, evaluating people and thinking about organizational structure and things like that, and communicating with employees. And that I thought, you know, that I think I could do. And I still think that that's doable. But the certain industries and certain businesses are so complex and different and unique that having had deep experience in the healthcare world was of great value. I didn't have that. And I really saw that, and especially today with the world changing so much. But even again, in the last 10 years, healthcare has been one of the fastest changing, most complex businesses. And so it really became clear to me, while I kind of half the equation I might have had, which is general leadership skills, the healthcare world was completely foreign to me. I learned a lot, but clearly somebody with deep experience in that world would be better. I also learned a bit about, I was working with the University of Minnesota, and we were trying to come together in a merger of some form, and I kind of blew that up by mistake. So I had my issues there. There was a lot of learning about my own personal style and skills and so forth. So it was surprisingly humbling, and there was a lot of personal growth and learning for me, even though it was very late in my career. So always room for improvement. I learned that.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about, you've served on a number of boards. You've given back as far as in the community. Do you think, you know, one of the questions I get asked a lot by leaders is, you know, around board work and getting involved with boards. Any advice you'd give to somebody that is looking to maybe sit on their first board and you do differently?
So there's kind of two sides to the coin. One is, most importantly, you want to be able to add value. So some companies might be a great asset as a board member to bring value. And some companies, you might not be as good a fit. Now, again, there's certain things on any board that you might help with. You know, all these companies need audit and controls and so forth. You know, those are transferable. Other skills might be business to business or consumer driven or supply chain driven or, you know, whatever. And so you certainly want to think about companies where you say, I think I can add some value. That's very rewarding when you feel that way. And of course, it's good for the company that you serve. The flip side of that is you want to learn and get something from that. So the other members of the board are an important part of the equation of whether that's a good fit for you and whether it's something you'd be excited about. The industry, if it's interesting to you or not, that's legitimate. You know, what things are important to you from and you find exciting to learn about, because in most cases you'll be learning a different business. So I think those are kind of both. You want to be able to contribute, but also get learning for yourself. And so one of the things I do when I go into an external board meeting, I take a piece of paper and I draw a line down the middle. And on one side, I write my thoughts as the meeting goes on about things that I think might help the company for the board. So I'll write down something like, ooh, I learned, you know, I know something from my experience about, you know, IT security, something we experienced, or, you know, whatever it would be. And on the other side, I write down things that I learn in the board meeting that I'm going to take back to Red Wing, for example. And usually my list on the left, you know, the one that here's what I'm going to go back to Red Wing with is much longer than the contribution sure. I think I'm making on the right. But it's interesting that I've always got both hats on, if you will. I'm always thinking from both perspectives. Right. How can I help, let's say, Mortenson Construction? I serve on their board. How can I help Mortenson? And, ooh, what do they do that maybe we should do at Red Wing? Or other companies. Now I'm not, you know, I'm still on the board of Red Wing, so I can share those thoughts. Certainly while I was a manager at Red Wing, I could glean from my boards. And now I can share circumstances from one company to another, you know, and certainly one of the areas today is very relevant is what do we think about incentives, compensation in this time when businesses might be way off of plan, way off of where they thought,
right?
Not through any fault of their own. If you work for a movie theater company and they close the movie theaters, it's not your fault, you know,
right.
So what do you do? But yet you want to retain good people. You want to be fair. And so I'm kind of calibrating against other companies. So that's how I kind of think about it. If you're interested in a board, where do you bring value and where can you get value?
No, I love that. It seems simple, but I think a lot of times people fail to look at both sides of that. That's a great thought. So with continuing to grow and develop, what books do you recommend to leaders that you talk to or that you've mentored?
You had talked to me once before I answer that, you had talked to me once before about, you know, any other kind of advice I might have for somebody who serves on a board or interacts with a board. And my answer there, because I think it's an important one, is just absolute, complete candor and transparency. If you're the CEO and you're talking to your board, you know, absolute transparency and candor is number one, the best way to get the best from your board, most importantly. And number two, it builds incredible trust. And so when things aren't going well and you're honest about it, they're going to cut you more slack than if you, you know, it's sort of like you got a, you know, 5-year-old that takes candy from the candy jar.
Sure.
You're much more forgiving if they admit they did it, you know, or whatever. Or it may just be an honest mistake. Oops, I dropped the candy jar and it broke. You know, just being real clear and transparent on both good and bad is really important. And it's also just so much more rewarding to just have that kind of close personal relationship with your board members.
Sure.
And when you're that open and candid, you can have that. So anyway.
So if you've ever gotten, you know, maybe going back to where you had a board that you're working with.
Yeah.
Talk about a time maybe that something happened that you got sideways with somebody. And how do you resolve some of those as far as at a board level?
So I can give two examples. One, I was on a board, a public company that had just gone public, but still had some significant ownership from by the private equity firm. Mm-hmm. So there was still skin in the game for this private equity firm. And so what I soon realized after going on the board as kind of when it first went public is that there were very different agendas within the board. It's a little different kind of circumstance than you're referring to, which I'll speak to in a minute. But it really was the most difficult and least enjoyable board I ever served on because we didn't all have the same, what I thought were the appropriate goals and values as to what we should expect and how we should behave as board members, where some were just, it was all about the money, you know, how do we maximize value and get our money out? And I'm not throwing anybody under the bus. It's just, there were just clearly different backgrounds and objectives that made it difficult to, so that was a kind of a difficult situation. Another one is I serve as chair of the board of one of the companies of a privately held company. And the CEO, to his credit, said, is this a subject? We were talking about some topic. And he said, is this one you want to talk to the shareholders about? And it's a limited small group of shareholders. And I said, no, I don't think we need to do that. And that was a mistake. I wasn't living by the transparency, completely open. I wasn't trying to really hide anything, but I just thought we don't need to get complicated that way. And so I took a shortcut. And then when the board meeting, and it came up in the board meeting, they called me on it. You know, like, why didn't we know about this? And I quickly acknowledged, I own this. I didn't want the CEO to take the heat.
Sure.
I said, I own this. I had made that decision. I made a mistake. I should have talked to you about this in advance. I apologize. And I'd like to table this topic until I do have a chance to circle back with the shareholders and we'll re. So it was an embarrassing, you know, circumstance. I owned it. I fessed up to it right away, but I'm like, oops. So, you know, the other kind of circumstance where it can be uncomfortable is when there's real strong disagreement among board members. I was at a not-for-profit board meeting recently where I had a very strong disagreement about a certain direction that I think most board members were going to do. I could sense that some board members didn't agree with the decision but didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. Some board members did agree with the decision and said something. And I disagreed with the decision and said something. And there are a few that did. But, you know, you want a board that speaks up. And mm-hmm. don't go on a board if you're not willing to speak up to say what you believe. If they don't want to hear what you believe, they shouldn't want you on their board.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know how we got there. But I'm ready to talk about the books. You want to talk about the books?
Yeah, let's talk about the book. No, I appreciate that you know that was some good stuff. And no, I appreciate you being real open and transparent about, you know, sometimes people only share the highlights of their life. So it's helpful to hear, you know, when things don't always
go. Well, I love your, the only reason I wanted to talk about the books is I am a real avid reader. I love to read. And so I will tell you the three books. There's three books that really occurred to me from your question. One is Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, about capitalism. I read that when I was very young. I was in business school, which I think of as very young at this point. I didn't at the time, but it really was a real look into capitalism and the pros and cons and the ups and downs of that. And so I found it was really one of the heavier books I had read versus kind of junky detective novels or whatever. So that really had an impact on me. It's particularly when I was in business school, thinking about that. And then a book that I read every year, actually, and I have every single, is A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. Hmm. Because there you've got a capitalist of the hardest firm, you know, form, completely converted to realizing the value of capitalism to do good. And I love the story, you know, I could almost quote the whole book because I've read it every year during the holidays, but it's not a holiday story. It's a story of coming to understand the value. And I remember, you know, there's a point when he tells somebody who's, you know, these two folks that are trying to raise money for the community, he blows them off and says, well, they should be in prison. You know, that's what we have prisons for. To all of a sudden then giving, you know, a significant amount after his conversion to the community and realizing. So that's always played in my mind about this wonderful, it's not a balance or a choice. It's actually, they're very consistent that to do well in a business allows you to do good in your community. So that's the second one that is a very special book to me. And the last one is one many probably haven't even heard of called QB7 Leon Uris. QB7 stands for Queen's Bench 7. It's a story about a doctor in England who had a sterling reputation. and a reporter or a writer had uncovered what he believed was a dark past of this distinguished knighted doctor in England. And the claim by the author of this book was that this doctor had committed atrocities in a Nazi concentration camp. Hmm. And so, interestingly, he writes this about the doctor, and the doctor actually files a defamation suit, libel suit, I'm not sure which one is which, but basically says, you besmirched my reputation. And so he went to court, QB7 in Queen's Bench 7. And the story is about this trial. And what's fascinating about it, and it's relevant today, is as you read the book, 1 minute you think this doctor is indeed a horrible Nazi, you know, perpetrator. And then literally in the next chapter, you think he's being maligned and is not guilty of these charges. You're not guilty of what he's being, you know, branded with.
Sure.
And I mention it because it's one of the great books I've ever read. I think you can still get it. Hmm. You don't know whether he's actually, which he was. Was he the bad guy or was he a maligned good guy who was tarnished unfairly? And you don't know till the very end of the book. Okay. So it's a great read. But it made me think about today. Think about how quickly people's reputations have gone one way or the other by a claim that may very well be true. But, you know, there's so much judgmental, you know, things going on. You know, probably the most visible was the, you know, Brett Kavanaugh, you know, hearings. And I'm not making a judgment about Brett and whether he's guilty or not. Again, I don't know. All I know is it's really a challenge. And we are pretty quick to kind of, and I'm not speaking of that situation, but in the political world, you know, I think, as Biden said, we tend to demonize, you know, those that we don't agree with. So this came to mind for me in the last year or so in particular. So I'd encourage people to read it. It's a great book, and it might be relevant for today's world.
Okay. Well, that one I've never heard of, and definitely we'll take a look. Definitely look forward to it. Yeah, definitely. So outside of what you're doing, you sit on boards still. You're officially retired, but doesn't sound like you're retired. You're still working and engaged in a lot of different things. So what do you do outside to recharge
what are some of your interests? So I have a nice balance now. I serve on three corporate boards and then one not-for-profit. And as I said, I'm chair of one of the boards. So I'm still busy enough, but they tend to meet in the same quarters, right? They tend to meet in fiscal quarters generally. So it's nice that I have these gaps. So I have a lot of hobbies. I'm really into photography in a big way. I have a website, surfthemurf.com, which I post my photos on. And so some people are welcome. There's a lot of family type photos, but I take photography very seriously. So I travel to do photography. Wildlife is a big thing I do. I do some portrait work. I do a bunch of different photography things. That's really fun. I'm a woodworker, so I do woodworking. I have a shop and I'm trying to knock stuff together. It's not too fine of stuff, but I can make a bench or something like that.
Okay.
So I do that. I love to read. As I said, I'm a snow skier. Love to ski. So that's probably my best kind of what I do for activity. And I love to cook. Okay. I'm into baking now. I mean, as a lot of people are, but I've always been, especially at General Mills, I was always a foodie. And so I love to bake and cook and barbecue. And so I'm actually now marrying my cooking with my photography. So I'll cook something, I'll photograph it, food photography, try and do a good job of that. I'm learning that. And then I put the recipe together and I share it with people in the family and stuff. So I have lots of things. I am not one, and there are people who don't know what they're going to do when they retire. That was never an issue for me.
Okay. Well, that's great. No, I definitely will check it out. And I'll have to, when we get down, I'll ask you for your list of favorite restaurants, since you're a foodie in the, in the Twin Cities. So what parting advice would you give a leader during this kind of unusual time in our history?
Well, first of all, I'm glad I'm not running a company right now. I mean, this is a tough, tough time. I know. Yeah. I think what I have been talking with the CEOs about is, number one, keep your chin up. Hmm. You know, this is a time when it can be really tough because they're making tough decisions that they have to make. When making those decisions, try and balance, you know, the needs of all the stakeholders, mm-hmm. the employees, the shareholders. Obviously you need to make decisions that you hope and you believe is the better word, will help the company come out at the other end as a better company. I think that is a fair compass kind of way to think about. You are going to make choices that aren't ones that work well for certain individuals. You are going to, and stakeholders, there's going to be times when you spend money that shareholders won't, you know, might be value right now. But if you really are using as a true north, what do I do to make this company the best company it can be in the future? That too will serve all stakeholders, employees, customers, shareholders, the community. So not easy decisions. But if you use that as a compass, I think 9 times out of 10, they'll be the right kind of decisions, or ones at least that help you sleep at night and feel good, even if they don't all turn out to be right.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Dave. This has been a lot of fun. Really enjoyed our conversation and just some of your insights from your years of leadership. And as you continue to stay active and involved, and look forward to checking out your website and seeing your photography.
Well, thanks, Mark. When you asked me to do this, I mean, I don't have all the answers for leadership. Yeah, you know, I think your listeners are going to very quickly see that. But I mean, it's just one set of experiences and point of view that people can take the best and leave the rest. And, you know, probably hopefully they'll learn more from my mistakes and faux pas than they will other things. But it is something, great leadership is something I think now more than ever we can all see is really important in whatever kind of, whether you're in politics or in private business or in not-for-profit or whatever. It's hardly anything is more important. So I'm glad that you help people better understand and think about leadership.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.